Welcome to It's All Journalism. I'm Megan Cloherty, here today with Mike O'Connell. Let's get social, as in social media, of course. Our guest today is Mandy Jenkins, the interactive editor at Digital First Media. Before taking that job, she was the social news editor at the Huffington Post, so it's fair to say she knows her way around TweetDeck. Good morning, Mandy. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into social media, tell us first about Digital First and your new gig.
Well, Digital First, for those that aren't really familiar with it, it's kind of a strange animal because we're a digital company that's overseeing two newspaper companies, essentially. So our CEO, John Payton, said he's going to put digital people in charge, and that's what he did. And so I work for kind of the national part that's overseeing newspaper companies, which if you told me just a few years ago that I would be working in newspapers again, I probably would have laughed at you. But it's an exciting place where we're doing a lot of experimenting and trying out new storytelling forms and just trying to figure things out. But my role there, I oversee the data team and the video team, and I also work a lot in community engagement with our local newsrooms.
Oh, cool. And so what is there any particular project that you worked on recently?
Well, right now, we've kind of been essentially pulling the teams together. We're probably doing one of the craziest hiring sprees that's probably happening in newspapers right now. Mm-hmm. So we've been getting our team together and getting them situated. But one of the things I've been working on quite a bit is rolling out a product that we built with a vendor called the Social Media Wire. Mm-hmm. And you could see that on the New Haven Register's website. They were our first site to test it. It's really interesting because it's essentially pulling together local feeds of RSS, local blogs, YouTube channels, different tweets from all around an area to kind of give a place to focus in on what's happening in social media there. So I've been doing that in, 70-some cities. So it's been pretty crazy to build that.
So is it the idea behind that then is to sort of build community engagement for a particular news outlet?
Right. It's kind of trying to pull together the people who read newspapers and the people who read social media, because this way someone can see what's happening on social media and other sites in their area, but they don't necessarily have to be on Twitter yet to see that. So it's kind of a blending of worlds that goes on with it.
It's so funny. That makes me think of, I was at a store, like a sporting goods store a few months ago, and it was for the ESPYs was on, and one of the broadcasters was all of a sudden he said, well, you know, if you look at the bottom of us, you're seeing something scrolling by that's our Twitter feed. Don't be afraid. That's, you know, you can just sort of keep track of what's going on. So
it was a separate world.
Exactly. Don't be afraid, whatever this message is.
Watch out for that Twitter.
So you have to figure out who are their original followers in that community and then maybe try and pull in some new ones. Do you go to each of these cities or how does that work?
Well, essentially, we're working with the local editors there, and they're saying, you know, these are the sources in our area that our readers find interesting, which can be kind of hard for them because a lot of the time that means their competition is involved in these feeds, too, because we want it to be pretty well-rounded. You know, we want the reader to come to this, and it's just a box, essentially, that's on the side of a lot of their pages, and then there's a full-screen version where they can see all of this happening.
So they don't have to go to their competition. They can see it all there.
They can just browse it there and hang out on the site and watch the news go by. I mean, everyone's gotten so used to the bottom line on CNN and ESPN that it's kind of the next step. So,
was there like a tough sell for some of those newsrooms that, you know, okay, you're going to have to acknowledge the fact that you have competition and that they're part of this dialogue?
Well, some places, yeah. I mean, because you can't necessarily blame them when you're thinking, why would I send someone to their website? But when we start talking about the fact that, you know, we're talking about people staying on this site, looking at it here, you know, if they want to see more, they'll click off. But I mean, they're going to come back if they know that this is here, mm-hmm. that we're creating a hub here. And once you kind of get that part going, it's a lot easier to digest when you're kind of at the local level and dealing with that.
So you've built a career in social media journalism. And how did you go from traditional journalism to social media? Did that happen sort of on its own, or did you direct it that way?
I definitely directed it that way. And in hindsight, I kind of can't believe I guessed right. Because it was like 2007, and I was a web producer for news for the Cincinnati Inquirer. And so, you know, I was, you know, placing the news on their sites, watching their analytics, kind of doing a traditional producer-type job. And I wanted to do something bigger. I wanted to be something more there. And I wasn't necessarily what you would say in line for a management position when there was already a ton of managers there. So I was like, you know, I need to find my place here. And I had started to, you know, notice more about social media. I was reading about it. There weren't a ton of news outlets using it yet. I think it was only really the Chicago Tribune and the Austin Statesman that had really been doing any big experimenting there. But I was like, I'm going to be our social media editor. So I wrote up this huge manifesto of sorts of why I thought our paper should be in social media, exactly what the structure should be for how we would roll this out to reporters, how we train reporters, the role that everyone would take in the newsroom in using social media on our site, like comments and forums, plus Twitter and Facebook. And I gave this to our editor thinking he's probably going to laugh at me, because who has a social media editor at any newspaper in 2007? And they actually bought it, which I couldn't believe. So in like February of 08 was when I became the social media editor there. And then I actually had to go do all the things that I put into that manifesto. But I'm really glad I did. It was scary because I called the like only two other social media editors I'd even heard of in news and was asking them about their jobs and trying to figure out my way. But it seemed to work out, so I'll take it.
How long did you stay in the paper before you decided to move to bigger things?
Oh, I was there until 2010 when I went to TBD. And that was just an offer I couldn't refuse.
Yeah. Yeah. We've had a couple of TBD alums in here, Steve Buttrey, Jim Brady, of course. Can you just sort of just in a nutshell, for those who may not have heard those broadcasts or podcasts and who may not be familiar with TBD, what TBD was in sort of its brief, bright, shining moment in social media and digital media in general?
Yeah, TBD is kind of like the freaks and geeks of local news.
13 episodes,
yes,
that was all it
13
was.
Episodes. Everyone went on to do other things that were interesting. But essentially, TBD was a local news startup here in Washington, D.C., that was started by Jim Brady. And he had come from WashingtonPost.com and wanted to do something new and different. So he teamed up with All Britain Communications, who had Politico, and it was had a very exciting atmosphere there, because essentially they were going out hiring people for kind of non-traditional local journalism roles. I mean, we had reporters and editors, but we had a big community engagement team. We were working with television. We were doing a bunch of experimentation with new tools and new kinds of storytelling. And I, coming from the Midwest, first of all, thought for sure they would never hire anyone from the Midwest for this job. And I think I was like one of two people that was hired from,
well, Steve Buttrey's
from not
from
the
Iowa,
East Coast. So. Well, I mean, he's been everywhere. I don't think Buttrey knows no borders.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true.
But it was a really interesting place because we had a lot of freedom to try lots of different things there. So,
what are you doing now that you learned from that experience? Because I know that experience for most of the people we've talked to was a huge takeaway. What are you doing from there?
And people looked a lot, I think, to what TBD had done. I think, you know, some people like clucked their tongues and said, oh, well, they lived and they died. But I think that they saw a lot of lessons that came out of that, good lessons.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of us took away, for one thing, how important collaboration is, particularly if you're working in smaller staffs. And not only just collaboration internally, I mean, obviously working across your own departments, but working outside, too. I mean, we built a network of local blogs here in the D.C. area that really made it so we're kind of pulling all this news together from D.C. and Virginia and Maryland that really hadn't been done. I mean, there was our main competitor news-wise was the Post. And how do you even compete with the Washington Post?
Right.
They're huge. But this is kind of like amassing an army of small things to tackle a big news problem, which was kind of a lack of local news in some areas in D.C. And I think that collaboration was something that inspired a lot of us. A lot of us went on to do a lot more of that, a lot more with crowdsourcing, a lot more with working with other writers, and generally just a lot more of continuing to experiment with how we want to write news, report news, and find sources.
Mm-hmm. Now, and I know we were talking before we started recording. You came and you spoke to the class that Megan and I were in at American University, Amy Eisen's class, another guest that we had here before. And at the time, you mentioned, you told the story of the sort of hostage shooting thing at the Discovery Channel and how that was kind of like a watershed moment for TBD in the way that you were doing your news. Could you sort of tell that story?
Yeah, sure. Well, we were had only been going for about a month because we'd launched TBD in early August, and this was, I think, September 1st when this happened. And we had an initial report from, I think it was the spouse of someone that worked at our TV station, who called us and said that there was a hostage situation happening. So we were able to kind of get our heads together really before it was reported that it happened. So that, you know, meant that, you know, yeah, the news station sent their helicopter and, you know, we had a reporter going, but the place was already all shut down. And so what I did was, being the social media editor and being nosy anyway, I opened a bunch of Twitter searches because I was trying to find people who were either tweeting from inside of the building or near the building to try to get an idea of, you know, how we could get sources that were already inside of there. And doing this before the news was reported ended up being the best thing I could have done, because it was so much easier to get it before people were reacting to it. So just by doing a lot of keyword searches and doing some location-based searches around that area, I didn't find anyone inside the building tweeting, but I did find people in the adjacent buildings who were also locked in. And I'm going to think about, you know, if you're locked in a building because of a gunman, you are not getting any work done. Like, nobody is working when that happens. So everyone is on Twitter. They're taking photos out their office windows. They're tweeting them. I was getting in touch with these people via Twitter to say, hey, you know, tell me what you're seeing. Can we use your photos? And we were using it. And when they gave us permission, we used their photos on our site. We used them on television. It was a huge asset to have people who had this bird's eye view and who could tell us what they were seeing. And I think we had at least like 3 to 5 sources that were either contributing something online or were actually talking on television. They were giving us, you know, tips of what they were seeing, what they were hearing. And it was something that nobody else really had, because nobody could get into this perimeter. It was all shut down with the SWAT team. And it was a crazy experience for me, because I, for one thing, coming from the Midwest, while we did have a fair amount of Twitter users in Cincinnati, I couldn't conceive of being able to actually pull off this kind of crowdsourcing and source finding in social media before. So it was honestly kind of a watershed moment for me, too. It kind of took me to a whole other level of appreciating social media after that day. And I didn't move for like 10 hours. At the end of the day, I'd been sitting, and I sit on an exercise ball when I'm working. I just kind of noticed, like, I haven't even moved my legs in like 10 hours since this hostage crisis started. And so it was a wild day for all of us, though, because we had a live running coverage happening. Everyone's working on this story. We're working with the TV people. It was just kind of a shining moment for us. Like, it was a, I'd say that was our mountaintop during the short life of TBD, was that particular event.
It was so interesting, too, because I think a lot of times when people who don't know social media and they don't know how to use social media think of it as it applies to news, they think it's like a side conversation to the story that's going on. And really, this was like perfect example of how it is the story. I mean, if you can crowdsource it and get people's, you know, thoughts and opinions and emotions as it's happening – I mean, it's such a cool way to tell a story.
It's like turning, it's like opening a window, like hundreds of windows or cameras or whatever, you know, in the vicinity of something that's going on at that moment. I'm thinking recently, I mean, we're seeing it on tons of other stories after that. I'm thinking of the shooting up in New York, where somebody walked into an office building and suddenly there was all of this material that was showing up on Twitter of, you know, people taking pictures and, you know, in real time as the news outlets are tweeting as well and scrambling to get reporters and cameras and helicopters to a place. So just, you know, real-time reporting and crowdsourcing it, it's really kind of amazing how this has changed news gathering at this point.
A lot of our listeners are interested in learning more about how to do these things, you know, how to do these things that you're an expert in. Last week we had Josh Hatch on, told us a little bit more about how to do data visualization. So is there a good way or a good, you know, set of
guidelines
to go through to crowdsource? If something's happening in your city, what's a good way to start to see what conversations are out there?
Well, the first thing I always recommend, and I mean, I do this even when I'm not working, which probably means it's kind of a disease and an addiction, but I'm opening lots of keyword searches on Twitter. I mean, and that means lots of different windows, trying lots of different things. So saying, you know, like for this hostage thing, for instance, I put hostage, gunman, discovery. try to put in the address to see if someone was just saying, you know, what they were seeing going past there, looking for any kind of keyword combination that was going to start pulling people out. And doing that right away, too. It's I really can't stress how important it is to make that an early part of your process, because as soon as news gets reported, not only does your feed get, you know, filled up with people reacting to the news, but that's also when people start to actively try to make themselves part of the news. And because people have definitely caught on to the fact that news organizations are out there doing crowdsourcing on social media, and they inject themselves into it in a way to try to get themselves as part of the story. And that's a whole other part of crowdsourcing that I always warn people. It's like, yeah, you're finding this great stuff, but you cannot just take it at face value when you're seeing tweets on there. You have to get into conversations with people individually. So I usually say, you know, if you find something and someone that you want to talk to further for a story to cover that you found on social media, follow them. Maybe they'll follow you, maybe they won't, but at least that way you can say, you follow them, you send them a message and say, hey, I'd really like to talk to you more about this. Direct message me your phone number, because you can't keep it on social media. It's, for one thing, you're not going to get enough information for what you need, but that's also the best way to start verifying who someone is and what their connection to the story is if you're actually talking to them on the phone. Because if someone isn't necessarily representing themselves very well, the first thing that's going to fall apart is their story as soon as they're actually talking to you. It's easy to pretend that you're involved with something on Twitter, but it's not so easy once you're actually in a conversation with someone on the phone. And just really keeping our reporter instincts to us to say that, you know, a lot of these things aren't adding up, or, you know, let me know where else I can find information about this. Who else is with you? And once you see kind of more than one person, especially talking on social media about seeing the same things, you can really start to build kind of a narrative of what was happening there, at least in your head, as you're talking to people and putting together the facts as you found them on social media.
Well, and I remember when you had originally told us the story about the Discovery hostage situation, that the other side of this was, and you touched on it just a little bit, is that there was other reporting going on. There was other verification going on. And, you know, you as a social media person were doing your own stuff, but the fact is that there collaboration. There was a whole part of a newsroom that was involved in telling this story. So you were just telling one aspect of it that helped to feed some of that other reporting.
Definitely. And I mean, even the people, you know, the people I was finding through social media that I'm feeding over to producers, to editors, so they can interview them, they can talk to them. You know, I'm kind of the initial contact in a lot of cases. And then there were people that were also being found, you know, through our more traditional ways of who do you know that works here? Who do you know that knows somebody that works here? Kind of feeding our way through those channels, not to mention police, not that they were talking a whole lot about the situation, but what we knew, it was definitely something where we were able to attack that story from lots of different sides and get a better story because of it.
I know we were talking really kind of about a breaking news story, but you know, what about community engagement in the non-breaking news story? How does an editor or reporter sort of, you know, day in, day out, sort of build a rapport with their readers, their followers on Twitter and Facebook, et cetera?
You know, I talk about this a lot to our local papers and through the Online News Association, too. I do some work in that field. And I think that the thing I always tell everyone that's going to make this easy is to just be yourself. It seems like the easiest advice in the world. But just being yourself on social media makes people know that you're a human that they can talk to about things. And people sometimes take that to mean like, oh, I have to like tell them what I'm into all the time and what I ate for lunch. And I'm going to be one of those people that tweets about food and my life all the time. It's like, well, no, you know, it's about your comfort level and what you want to put into it. But being responsive, you know, answering questions, asking questions of people. And the thing I stress the most is, you know, interject yourself into the conversation sometimes. In real life, it might seem kind of weird that you're at this cocktail party and you see two people talking and they're like, are you guys talking about The Godfather? I love The Godfather. We should all talk about The Godfather. But that on social media, that's not only acceptable, but welcomed. If you are doing searches on social media for stories in your area, for issues in your area, or if something just kind of happens to go past you, reply to that, jump into it. It's kind of the best way to ingrain yourself with people is to say, hey, you know, I bring something to the table in this too. We should talk about this. And I know moving here to DC from Ohio, I mean, I didn't really know that many people, and I'd come from my own little social media pocket in Cincinnati. And that's exactly how I personally built my little network in DC, was just by butting into lots of conversations about things that I found interesting.
When you came in and spoke with us last year, you were mentioning something about how to handle mistakes on social media, which I think a lot of people don't know how to do, because it's so easy to delete it, and they don't get that it really isn't deleted.
Right.
Can you kind of go into, I mean, obviously big mistakes, I think as a journalist, you know you need to correct, put a correction out there, spelled somebody's name wrong or something. But hey, it's just a spelling mistake, or it's just, you know, tell me how you handle that.
Well, there's kind of different ways to handle different kinds of mistakes, I would say. For most mistakes, you know, we're talking a fact that's either changed or maybe you got it wrong the first time around, or a misspelling or a broken link, something like that. I always recommend sending a follow-up tweet, or on Facebook, sending a follow-up update of some sort and saying, okay, that last thing was wrong. This is the correct information. And, you know, just admitting to it and going on from there. Just tweet it again. You might even send the same exact tweet and just put in parentheses, corrected link, corrected spelling. That way people know why it was sent twice. And then I usually say don't delete. I mean, deleting it, it's fine if it's in your stream. That's fine. But if it is something where it's kind of a matter of public safety, or it's something where it could be a potential libel problem, then you might want to delete it, but you need to own up to the fact that it happened in the first place, because it is still going to be out there. It's either sitting in someone's tweet deck, because when someone deletes something, it doesn't necessarily delete it from every client, or they took a screenshot if it's particularly hilarious or particularly bad. So owning up to it is the most important part, because any time that you see people get really upset about a mistake on social media, it's usually because someone didn't own up to it, not because they did. They'll forget about it.
Right. It's about being transparent, is what you said last time. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, you need to make sure that, you, like you said, be yourself, own up to your mistake. And I mean, I think that it, especially at WTOP where I work, we're very into like MT, RT, like the different, you know, different kind of, what's the word I'm looking for?
Stuff. I don't know.
Well, like Twitter lingo. I think that a lot of times news organizations worry about being cool and being, you know, using the right lingo on Twitter or whatever, instead of just saying, hey, we spelled that name wrong. Sorry about that. I mean, right. what do you think about that?
No, I think that, you know, I think a lot of people do try to just be a little too clever too. I mean, it's like, you know, this is still, you know, we're just still talking. You're just talking. It isn't about trying to be the coolest person in the world here. And everyone makes a mistake, so just own up to it. And, you know, and especially when I was running TBD's Twitter account, which was a very, you know, back and forth, everyone knew they could have a conversation there, ask questions. You know, I had to admit to lots of mistakes, especially in the beginning when I didn't know my neighborhoods very well. I would get called out all of the time for being like one neighborhood off in Capitol Hill. It's like, oh, that isn't Capitol Hill. That's the Atlas District. You can't confuse those two. And I'll write back and be like, okay, sorry. You're right. This isn't Capitol Hill. It's the Atlas District. Oh, it's Eckington, or it's, you know, one. It's not Bloomingdale. It's this. So it's that was when I got called out on all the time early on at TBD, where I would see it on the map and, oh, the map's not right. Google doesn't ever know these things. So getting the owning up to those, and it honestly led to me learning a lot about it. It led to the people who often, you know, wanted to correct me on that, you know, helping me out over time. So sometimes when I was wondering about a neighborhood, I actually could direct message them and say, hey, you're the expert in this sort of thing. Where is the, what neighborhood is this in? And they're like, thank you for asking.
Yeah. People, it's funny. People like to have people be nice to them. I mean, we talk about best practices and things, but, you know, we almost need a Miss Manners for social media as to how to talk to each other. I mean, that's the funny thing is that we're a lot of these lessons, you know, be honest, be transparent, say, you know, acknowledge when you made a mistake and say you're sorry. I mean, that's just social etiquette. I mean, we're not thinking that we need to apply it in this new realm.
Yeah, they're kindergarten rules, really, when you get right down to it.
Well, my rule is always, you know, play nice in the sandbox.
Speaking of, you know, TOP or Huffington Post or some of these larger Washington news organizations, what do you think that news organizations are doing right when it comes to social media now? Because they're kind of starting to get it, But I imagine that also means there's some pitfalls.
For one thing, I mean, I always stand amazed at seeing just the growth in people using social media, not just using it, because I mean, a lot of people have had Twitter accounts for a while, but using it to find sources, using it to verify information, that you're really seeing that happen a lot more often, just within the last year than you used to. Like, there for a while, people would easily start up a hoax Twitter account for whatever, insert name of foreign government leader here, and they would believe it. It would turn into this news thing, and then they'd find out they were duped. And I think you're seeing a lot less of that. I'm remembering, gosh, when was this? It was maybe 6 months ago when someone had created a fake Twitter account for the Minister of the Interior in Egypt, mm-hmm. and it reported that Hosni Mubarak had died, and and that was all the, and people exposed this account in like 10 minutes, like five different news organizations exposed this. And I think that even 6 months before that, that probably would have been taken at face value by a lot of people. I think people are a lot more savvy in news about social media and its pitfalls than they used to be. Obviously, mistakes still happen, but I think everyone's starting to really kind of get ingrained in themselves how important verification is, how important fact-checking besides social media is. I mean, obviously, it's not perfect, but we are getting a lot better at it. And I've really noticed that as being a huge change in a very short amount of time.
So tell us about your experience at Huffington Post. You were a social media editor, is that what it was?
I was a social media editor for politics there, and which was a pretty exciting job to have throughout the beginnings of the whole Republican primary. It was my time period there. It was a pretty crazy time. Huffington Post is really, it's an amazing news organization. There's just so many people there. They're very bright. And it's probably the most fast-paced environment I've ever been in. Mm-hmm. I mean, working in increasingly fast newsrooms from newspapers and then at TBD, where I thought, wow, we're working really fast at TBD. And then I go to Huffington Post and I was like, we were not working very fast at TBD, like not even close. I mean, they are a well-oiled machine as to how news gets in and out of there. And it's really impressive to be a part of that. Because they have the reporters, but also some of the best people in social media are there doing all of this scouring, doing all this finding of information. And it was great to be a part of that. It really was.
Well, yeah, definitely. They're all over social media. I know that I follow several people on there, and they break so much stuff, and some of it very newsy, some of it not so newsy. But you know, they're also really good about writing headlines and tags
that
makes you want to click on something guiltily.
I think it's interesting too that now you're teaching. You're an adjunct professor at Georgetown, right. And I think this brings up a question. I was chatting with a friend the other day, and he is a journalist. He has his own personal Twitter, and then he has his handle, his reporter handle, and so he's tweeting from his personal handle, like it doesn't matter, and he's tweeting from his reporter one, very like, you know, very specifically about his
grown
stories.
His grown up
voice, right? And I told him, I was like, you know, anybody can find either one of these. It's not like you're, you know, you disappear when you take your reporter hat off. And I think it might be interesting to talk to you just about, especially for students or young journalists who are coming up, who have to think about sort of changing their voice or what they're throwing out there. And also, if it matters if you have your, you know, if you have your news organization handle in your, or news organization name in your handle, I mean, does that change what you put out? I don't know. It's worth talking about.
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's always interesting because so much of that depends on the news organization. I mean, some news organizations have very strict social media policies that just stifle their staff to where they say, we own your handle. We own everything that you're sending out here. Your Twitter account belongs to us. Your Twitter account is an extension of us. And so you have to operate this way on there. And so in that kind of circumstance, it completely makes sense that you might want your own handle to go off and, you know, talk about sports and talk to your friends. But if there aren't rules like that, you know, I think it's great to have one place for everything, because that's that part of being transparent and being myself. I know I have all, for one thing, I only want to manage one. The idea of managing more than one personally is exhausting to me, especially when I was running news organizations ones all the time. But, you know, that's a place where, yeah, I talk about journalism a lot. I promote my blog. I promote the work of people in my news organization. But I also put out angry tweets about football games and make fun of people on television just like everyone else. And I think that it's everybody kind of has to find their own way as to how they want to present that, but they definitely need to be cognizant that no matter what they're putting online and no matter where and no matter how much privacy they think they might have on Facebook or Twitter on a private account, that they still have to be thinking like a journalist and writing like a journalist. I mean, you can't use your personal account to berate the people on your beat that you're writing about objectively on another account, which I have seen happen before.
And we've seen people who've lost their jobs for saying, well, I don't know if it's necessarily something against their beat or whatever, but saying something on their Twitter account that's identified with them as a reporter that is less than positive.
Well, that's why I think it's interesting, especially for younger journalists or your students, because, when you're in college, you're not thinking about 5 years from then when you're going to have, a professional job and be a journalist. I mean, how do you talk to them about sort of not a code of conduct, but just kind of what to be aware of?
Oh, yeah. And, it's something that it's funny that I don't even just have to talk to students about this.
Right.
I mean, there are lots of people who could use the lesson at times. But, I always say, especially when you're starting to get into when you're looking for work, that you need to clean up that your entire social media presence. Everything needs to be examined and gone back over. Things need to be made private that should be made private. You definitely need to make sure your settings all reflect that, no party photos of you are going to be visible on your page, that you're not talking about things that you wouldn't want a potential employer to see. Because even if you think that they're not going to find it, they're going to find it, and they're going to look for it. I mean, that they want to know that you're savvy at what you're doing and that you're not an idiot who's going to be putting their company at risk once they hire you. And I stress that all the time. And I said, it's not to say that you have to be boring, but it's to say that you have to act like a grown-up. So, no party photos. Maybe you shouldn't be have a bunch of, selfies of yourself all dressed up and you're not wearing very many clothes. You don't need to be taking a lot of those photos and putting them out on social media.
Oh, my.
And I always kind of use my personal example that, in real life, I don't necessarily have the best language. I can be kind of colorful sometimes. But I would never curse on social media, ever. Because I don't want that associated with what people see of me online if they don't know me.
You've got to brand yourself.
Right.
You got to go out there and, the Mandy Jenkins brand. You got to make sure you keep it how you want it.
Yeah. So no F words on the internet.
Yeah.
There we go.
It's
clean
a good
it,
rule.
Clean
yeah.
it up. Clean up the language.
How do you think reporters should be using social media that they're not doing correctly?
I think the hardest thing to get, it's kind of funny because I would often say in the past that the worst thing is that there's a lot of reporters that don't know how to talk to people like regular people, that they're very cognizant of using this as a broadcast method. Or even just as a very stiff method of communication where they're not being very personal or personable, not necessarily personal, but personable, being like a human. but now I feel like there's kind of problems at both ends of that spectrum. There are reporters who definitely overshare. I won't name any names, but there are quite a few of them in Washington political coverage, especially that just tweet all day long about whatever is on their minds at this exact moment. And I think that it's finding that happy medium between being relevant and being interesting and, being fun too, but also still keeping it from just overwhelming people and being maybe a little too into yourself. Because I think it's finding that middle ground between those two places. And I think that's hard for a lot of reporters I talk to because they see the one end of the spectrum of the people who are talking about themselves, their dog, what they ate for lunch, every little tidbit of news and what they think of it. And they're like, I don't want to be that. I'm like, you don't have to be that.
Mm-hmm.
Please don't. Don't do that. There's enough of that out there. And I think that's honestly the hardest part for them is finding where they're comfortable, what they have time for, and still making it something that's engaging and interesting. And making people know that they're there and they're listening.
Tell us about covering local news with social media. How does that work? What's a good best practice for that?
Well, a lot of it kind of depends on exactly where you are. A lot of our newsrooms for Digital First, for instance, they do use Twitter and they use Facebook. But in a lot of these communities, because we have lots of different size communities, all the way from big places like Denver and San Jose down to you know, very small cities like Carlsbad, New Mexico, or you know, Lebanon, Pennsylvania. I mean, we're all over the place. But in a lot of the smaller communities, and even especially rural, but not always, they're seeing a lot more use on Facebook than they are on Twitter. And that's where a lot of their community is, especially because of the growth on Facebook of kind of more traditional newspaper readers. People over 60, for instance, are huge on Facebook right now. They're growing all the time. And so a lot of what they're doing is doing some experimentation on Twitter and Facebook, seeing more on Facebook and saying, you know what, we're going to do a lot of work here. We're going to put our stories here. We're going to get our conversations here. And I think that experimenting is actually the thing that takes more time and might be kind of harder to wrap your head around if you're a local editor who's just trying to get their website updated and get their paper out. But they've really gotten some really good response from that. I mean, in some cases, it's just, hey, this state basketball championship just ended. Our local team won. Let's just put a photo up, just the photo of the team celebrating. And one of our papers in Michigan did that. And that photo is the most successful thing they've ever had on social media. Huh. Tons of comments, hundreds of shares. And this is a pretty small area, but everyone, you know, is capturing that community excitement and trying to find ways to do that in every community, whether it's knowing exactly what buttons to push. We have a community. It was it's in Torrington, Connecticut. And this was it was a while ago. It was probably like 6 months ago. But I was there visiting, and I was doing a social media workshop, and I was checking out their Facebook page. And for 3 days running, they'd had this ongoing conversation happening between them and their readers about people who believed they'd seen UFOs in this one particular area. And everybody wanted to talk about these potential UFOs. They're like, I've seen the lights. I've seen them at night. And it's like, this is where else but in a local community that's pretty small and somewhat isolated on the newspaper Facebook page would you get to see this kind of thing happening. It's great to see when you can find something that works that way and really captures people's kind of gossipy desire to talk to one another about what's happening.
So what do you think about people, I mean, having this conversation on Facebook as opposed to in comments on your own site? I mean, this sort of phenomenon, you know, I know there are a lot of newspapers are sort of wondering about that. Certainly people you're trying to sell this concept to, you know, get the discussion going on Facebook. But, you know, how do you, you know, what's the real benefit of doing that?
I think for one thing, you're kind of getting people where they already are on Facebook. It's already a tough sell to get them to come to the site. And in some cases, it's an even tougher sell to get them to want to comment there. I mean, unless they're really fired up. And right. Then you have to deal with how you moderate comments there, which is that's a whole other podcast that I could go into great lengths about how horrible it is to moderate newspaper site comments. But Facebook, you're getting them where they are. You're getting them somewhere where they're used to communicating, for better or worse. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be nicer to one another or nicer to you there. Mm-hmm. But at least they're there.
It's a pretty self-policing area, I think. You know, if somebody starts being a dick, you can, you know, somebody will call them to task or start yelling at them from another way.
Right.
You know, heat up that conversation. Yeah. As opposed to our comment boards. I'm thinking of our own comment boards on our website.
Well, it's interesting, too, because especially your perspective, you have an idea of how people are engaging with with the news stations, you know, in their market. How do you feel about the future of journalism now? How do you feel about the future of social media journalism?
Well, journalism itself, I think, is it's in a really interesting place right now. I think it's changing and it's kind of going through some growing pains. And, you know, everyone's kind of got their own opinions as to how that's going to end up. But I think it's going to end up in a great place just because, not just because of social media, but social media certainly plays a role in it because it is getting us in touch with readers that wouldn't necessarily be working with people like our tiny newspapers, that wouldn't necessarily be interested anymore because they don't read a print product or something like that. So I think social media is helping us in that sense. I do think that we're going to kind of move past that. I think we already are, not just, you know, from social media, but into different uses of it, into building things into our sites that are more social, into finding the next big thing that's not just Facebook and Twitter, whatever that might be. We have to be on the lookout for that and kind of trying to get our way into that before it's too late. But I think that we're moving past social. We're moving past looking at things that this is my little corner of the world that's happening on Twitter or Facebook, and this is the news. I think we're moving past all of that to where there is a mix. we're the ones that are going to determine what that mix will be between social media and news and everywhere in between. And I think that this is the time period when you're seeing all kinds of interesting things happen with that. New tools, new products being built, people figuring out how to use APIs in ways that are going to be even more useful for their websites to connect in with a social audience or with a larger online audience than they've already had. And I'm just excited to see what happens from there. I know I'm planning to continue to work in journalism for a long time.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Mandy. You know, it was excellent insight into social media. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me. This has been fun.
And of course, where can we find you on Twitter?
You can find me at M Jenkins. I'm frequently mistaken for two different football players on Twitter.
Okay.
But I am the real M Jenkins.
Okay. The real M. Jenkins.
So we've been speaking to the real M. Jenkins. This is Mike O'Connell, Megan Clorty for It's All Journalism. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of the media. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about us at itsalljournalism.com. We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com. Also look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @AllJournalism.